At Chapters, Fairview Mall, what time is the book signing beginning?
It starts at 1 o'clock. I'll be probably wrapping up around 5 o'clock, so from 1 to 5 tomorrow afternoon. And my book is finally out. It's Addiction, the Hidden Epidemic. And so I'll be bringing copies with me, and hopefully the store will be stocking them for me.
This is a fascinating looking book, Addiction, the Hidden Epidemic. And on the cover, I mean, we think about the typical addictions. You know, people have alcoholism in their lives. We've talked about drug addiction, you know, but you're looking prescription pills, but it looks like sugar and tobacco and gambling and caffeine. And I mean, addiction, we've gone wide ranging instead of thinking, well, you know, there's more to addiction than simply being an alcoholic or a coke addict. You know, that there are lots of addictions in our lives. Mm-hmm. Why did you write this book?
For several reasons. One main reason is because of our children today. They're very much at risk. The research is showing that about 20% of our children during their childhood are going to be diagnosed with a mental disorder. So they're very mentally unstable today. And this is unprecedented, of course, in the history of mankind. This is not normal to see children with ADD, ADHD, oppositional defiant disorder, whatever label these children are getting. It's not normal to see them so mentally unstable. And so, of course, mental instability is really one of the main precursors to developing addiction. So what we have is a perfect storm. It's the perfect storm right now in the area of addiction. We have two things going on. We have more things to become addicted to than ever in the history of mankind.
More access to them as well.
Absolutely. And then second to that, we have a bad mood epidemic. We have people who have everything from depression, anxiety, sleep problems, fatigue, all sorts of mood problems. So you put those two factors together and you see this addiction epidemic going on. And unfortunately, because of the stigma attached to both addiction and mood disorders, it's the elephant in the room. People don't want to talk about it. And you know what? When I looked around me and I saw the state of mind our children are in right now, I couldn't not write this book.
Now, when you talk about children and their, let's say, the mental states, could it not just be the case where we never had the diagnostic capability? In the 1850s, we just had children who were rambunctious, or in the 1600s, or even as late, you know, in the 1950s, we were just like, well, he's a very active, spirited child. Could it be that we're just able to diagnose more children than before?
No. I mean, if you talk to anybody, my father, who's almost 80 years old, he'll say, you know, when I was a kid, the kids were happy. They were excited to jump out of bed in the morning. They were respectful of adults. He didn't see this type of behavior among his peers when he was a child. And I find this consistently when I talk to people in their 70s or 80s. There's been a change happening with our mental stability. In fact, we're 100 times more likely to be depressed today than we were 100 years ago. And this level of fatigue where people in the 1980s, like myself, you know, collapsed with chronic fatigue, this is a huge, huge problem. Anywhere between 50 and 80% of doctor visits today, if you go see a GP, are for some sort of psychological issue. And that could be fatigue, it can be depression, anxiety, sleep problems, overall stress. And unfortunately, the remedy is toxic mind-altering drugs that have detrimental effects, have terrible side effects. And in fact, these drugs damage an already damaged brain. And, people who are taking these drugs will often complain that they made them feel worse than they felt before taking these drugs.
You know, it's interesting. Yesterday we talked about Catherine Zeta-Jones. And so she came out and said she was going in for bipolar. And I said, well, that's pretty interesting. You know, at least she has the bravery to say, I have a mental illness, which we often stigmatize. And then we talked to another caller yesterday. He said, you know what, Tom, I have bipolar too. And it's amazing. You know, you don't know anything's wrong. And it came on late. He was in his 40s. And now he takes, but he took medication to control it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can't we see that a lot of times that this could be genetic? That when we look at mental illness, for instance, when we look at depression or bipolar or schizophrenia, that it, to me, I would classify it as your brain has an imbalance of chemicals and there's nothing you could have done about it. But are you saying it could be something else that we could have slowly gotten there another way?
You're absolutely right. There is another factor to consider, and that is nutrition. We all know that when we eat terrible food, we feel terrible. I mean, we all know that. And when we put something in our mouth, of course, it will affect our brain function. Taking a drug for mood, of course, you're swallowing it, it's going into your stomach, it's affecting your brain. Food does the same thing. So what I do in my book is I basically distill it down into simple terms as to what are the nutrients that we need for our brain to function on. How is it that we evolved as human beings and developed such a great thinking capacity? What was it that we ate that allowed this to happen when it didn't happen with primates, for example, or very distant cousins? There are very, very distinct foods that feed our brain, and we are reducing our consumption. We have been very clearly reducing our consumption of these foods over the last 50 to 100 years, and it's basically causing a phenomenon that I call brain starvation. We are starving our brains, and when you're brain starved, it will manifest. Your first symptom of that is going to be some sort of psychological symptom. Now, and this is based on research. I'm not just making this up. There has been some research, but it's been ignored because the remedies have been chemicals. You take chemicals for this. When I'm saying, it's nutrition. And I have a compilation of interviews of psychiatrists, psychologists, therapists in my book who use nutritional approaches to cure both mood disorders and addiction. They have an 80% cure rate. And this is unprecedented. This is unheard of. And I think we need to learn from these people.
17 minutes after 9 o'clock, author Pam Colleen, who's new book, Addiction, The Hidden Epidemic, is just been released. She'll be at the Chapters at Fairview Mall tomorrow starting at 1 o'clock to sign some books. And she's going to stay with us. And I got a couple more questions. And she's available on a lot of topics. So we got a wide range, not just this book, but some other topics where she's been involved in. She's regularly guest down in our sister station down in London, but she's come up to Niagara for today. My name's Tom McConnell. You're listening on 610 CKTB. Pam Colleen, author, is joining me this morning. Her new book is called Addiction, The Hidden Epidemic, and Common Sense Solutions for Our Number One Health Problem. How much does addiction cost us?
It costs the Canadian economy about $40 billion every year in the United States.
Well, hold on a second. Every year?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that about our whole healthcare budget?
It's huge.
I guess $40 billion gets spread out over a lot of agencies and that.
Well,
that's
and
a
there's so
cost.
Many costs. I mean, you have to factor in costs for, productivity at work and all these other issues as well.
Okay.
But that's not even factoring in lost hopes, dreams, destroyed families, destroyed lives. I mean, you have to factor all that in with regards to substance abuse in particular. There are more deaths and disabilities every year from substance abuse than from any other cause. It's not cancer, heart disease, and diabetes that are our number one health problems. It is substance abuse. There's no question.
Haven't we, though, always been as a species? And I look at the hard addictions. Let me look at the hard addictions, and then I don't want to call it, hard and soft, but people are going to say sugar addiction is not the same as crack addiction. The one can really kill you. But when we look at the hard addictions like alcohol, so alcohol has been in our society, we started brewing beer thousands of years ago.
A few thousand years,
to clean up the water. And so we've had wine here for a long time. Hasn't man always wanted to alter his state? Haven't we always wanted to escape? That this is why we smoke marijuana, or this is why we self-medicate, because I want to get away from who I am. And so even before, we could have been the healthiest eaters, yet we still wanted to have that little escape. So isn't addiction, hasn't there always been a bit of a problem?
Not a problem so much, but we've always had use. We have always used mind-altering drugs. So you're absolutely right. It is almost natural for humans to want to change their state of mind and to be curious about these altered states. And so to experiment with mushrooms, to experiment with cannabis, we have done that historically. But something is very different today, Tom, and that is we have crossed the line from using to abusing. And explorers have studied primitive cultures where they have had mood-altering substances in their diets, in their midst.
Okay.
And they did notice that they used these substances, but they didn't see them abuse these substances. So this is, again, ties into what are we seeing today? Why are we seeing so much abuse overuse? I mean, vis-a-vis what our ancestors used to do.
All right. And then when I look at food addictions too, and isn't it weird that, I mean, we have taste buds. Sugar tastes good because our body craves it. I mean, glucose is used in every cell as the basic energy source. And we look at fat, ice cream tastes great because, it's the densest form of calories. So Is it a case where, you know, now food has never been cheaper or easier to get? That calories used to be tough. You had to work hard to feed yourself every day. But now we don't. Now we don't. So are we almost fighting against our own progress when it comes to food addictions?
What has really happened is, and the food industry knows this, they're making these foods to be addictive. And the foods I'm talking about are predominantly the foods you would find in the middle aisles of a grocery store. And 90% of our food dollars are spent on processed foods. And we have seen systematically over the last 100 years this rise of what I call big food, or these, you know, nutrient deficient foods that we find in our grocery stores today. When you walk into a grocery store, there are so many aisles loaded with these nutrient deficient foods that you cannot see the real food at the back of the store. It's blocking our view. I mean, these foods were unprecedented, predominantly prior to World War II. What happened was, at World War II, there were technologies to develop meals ready to eat for the soldiers that were in combat, and they needed something temporary to tide them over, of course. And these technologies, of course, a lot of money was spent to develop these technologies. And after the war, of course, they wanted to continue making money on having developed these technologies. So those technologies actually spilled over to make the thousands and thousands of foods that we see in the middle aisles of a grocery store. And these foods are not sustainable on a daily basis, 365 days of the year, year in, year out. These foods were designed for soldiers to go out into combat with during temporary periods. And so the food industry has been very clever in adding things to these foods to make them addictive. And they know they're addictive. Dr. David Kessler, who wrote the book The End of Overeating, he was the former head of the FDA. In his book, he basically says that the food industry knows damn well that these foods are addictive. And so it's very difficult to come off these nutrient deficient foods. And these are displacing foods. So if you're eating these foods, you're not eating the more nutrient dense foods that we know our brain needs so that it runs on properly.
And when you talk about the middle aisles, just before we go away to the break of news, when we talk about the middle aisles, and I'm just thinking about my own grocery store layout, it used to be, you know what, it's almost like for their own reasons, though, like every casino has slot machines that you have to pass through on the way to any place. This is one of the things about Vegas. If you want to go to the elevators, you got to go through the slot machines. You want to go to the pool, you got to go through the slot machines. You want to go to the middle aisles, as you say, dairies at one end, meats at another, bakery somewhere other corner. So if you want to go around the outside to the bakery to get fresh bread, if you want to get the meats, if you want to get the produce, if you want to and you want to get dairy, they've separated it. So no matter what, you got to walk.
Mm-hmm.
No matter
what, they force you down those middle aisles.
They force you down the middle aisles, and that's where their
most profitable foods are too.
It's tough to get around the middle, just like it's tough to avoid the slot machines.
Yeah,
at a casino.
What goes on in Vegas stays in Vegas, Tom. So you better cut short there with what you're. Any of your Vegas stories?
They'll welcome me back. I know they'll welcome me back. 27, and I'm not an addict. So that's, and again, talking of addiction, I mean, here they are trying to, I mean, they're trying to get you in to win big money because we're addicted. You know, I deserve a break. I need to get it. Anyway. Yeah. 9:28 is our time. Quick break in the program. Pam Colleen's going to join us for another segment. Talk about addiction, the hidden epidemic. And then with all these epidemics, what you can do, what people can do and your findings and what you find the research has done. And maybe give us some examples of people you know and have helped out in the course of their lives. My name's Tom McConnell. My guest is Pam Colleen. You're listening to News Talk 610 CKTB. Pam Colleen's my guest. She's the author of Addiction, the Hidden Epidemic. She'll be at the Fairview Mall Chapters. If you want to talk to Pam and get a copy of her book, have her sign it. She's there tomorrow, 1 to 5.
1 to 5. Thank you.
Very easy to find, people. It's right beside the QEW, so everyone knows where Fairview Mall is. Let me ask you, what's going on in our heads then? I mean, you talk about this addiction, how it's growing, how it's, you know, we're starving our brains. What's going on from a chemical point of view?
Well, because we're not eating enough animal foods in our diet, we have really been reducing our consumption of animal foods overall in the last 100 years and displacing those animal foods with more plant-based foods. And so because we've reduced our consumption of animal foods, we're neglecting very key amino acids that actually fuel your neurotransmitters in your brain. One very classic example of that would be something like tryptophan, which we know fuels a feel-good neurotransmitter called serotonin. So We're not getting the broad base of these amino acids in order to fuel these neurotransmitters. Secondly, of course, we're not getting the saturated fats that actually our brain relies upon.
Hold on a second, but when you bring up saturated fats, that's a red flag in a lot of people's minds. I have to cut down on my saturated fats, do I not?
Yes, saturated fats have been wrongly demonized now for about 50 or 60 years. We can't run on properly without these animal fats. We absolutely need animal fats. But what has happened in the last 100 years in particular has been the rise of the edible oil industry. So these are foods like corn, cotton, canola, and soy. And this can be a liquid oil, or it can be partially hydrogenated or turned into some sort of margarine or spread.
Okay.
Or it can be in the middle aisles of the grocery store as the fat that they use because it's a shelf-stable fat for many of the crackers and cookies and so on.
These are the fats, the trans fats, that we're trying to take out.
Absolutely.
So we've got that one right?
No. Well, by having those trans fats, of course, no, we haven't got it right yet, because they're still in these foods in the middle aisles of the grocery store. There's a lot of trickery going on the labeling, of course, because on the front package it says no trans fats, when indeed there are still going to be trans fats in the food. So you have to be a detective in order to, you know, find out whether there's trans fats in the food. But really, if there's a label, you don't want it. You know, that's what I tell my people. If you see a label, don't eat the food, because you can't trust the labels. And you know, the food industry time and time again proves that they're very deceitful in terms of, you know, the information that they provide on the package. And trans fats is just one source of trickery that they use. You know, in 1999, these trans fats got the label from the scientific community as being killer fats. These are killer fats, folks. And unfortunately, because so many thousands of foods contain trans fats, the food industry and the government were in a bind. And they said, how do we solve this problem, because now consumers are learning about these damaging fats. And so essentially they came up with a compromise, and they said that they could put on the label zero trans fats, but it's basically a ceiling. So if they achieve per serving, say, under a half a gram of trans fats in the serving, they can actually say there's zero trans fats. But let's say you add up over the course of the day, if you are eating these, you know, packaged foods, and you add up over the course of the day the amount of trans fats you're eating, you can still very easily take in 6, 7, 8 grams of trans fats a day. And that's a lot of trans fat. That's very damaging.
And you'd never know it.
And you'd never know it, because the label on the front says zero.
Now, so we don't have enough animal fats or good fats, saturated fats in our brain. We're not getting enough natural animal protein. I'm not going to think hot dogs are in there, but something like a chicken or turkey or red meat or pork or something, you know, less processed meat, you know, just, you know, put a steak on the barbecue. What else are we eating that's damaging our brain? I mean, when we look at carbs or other fats, do we have the balance right, or are we off there?
We're terribly off, because, you know, today we're skipping meals. We're waiting too long in between meals. What I ask my students to do is to eat 3 square meals a day and mimic a diet when we know during an era we were healthier than we are now. So prior to World War II, for example, we were healthier than we are now. And what did we do? We ate 3 square meals a day. We sat down and had a wholesome breakfast. We weren't fat phobic back then. We weren't cholesterol phobic. So we had our butter, we had our sausage, we had our eggs, we had bacon. And we weren't meat phobic. So, you know, for lunch or dinner, we would have had meat at some level. You know, these phobias that we've created in and around foods is really what's making us sick today. And this is a very clever marketing way that the industry, the food industry, and it's called negative nutrition. This is something that the food industry has been using for a long, long time. They use negative nutrition, just like how politics, you know, use negative advertising to try to claim the vote, right?
We're aware
in the food
of this
industry, they've done the same thing. So they demonize meat, they demonize butter in order to bring up more plant-based foods. And this is what we see. So, you know, you see the rise of, for instance, the soy industry. A lot of people today still believe that soy is a superfood, when indeed it's a food you really want to stay away from.
Really? Like, I mean, should I cut out soy sauce even that much? Where's soy? Where can I find it? And where would it be?
Well, you see it and now it's lining even the grocery stores. It started off in the health food industry. And what happened was, in like your Wesson oils, your Crisco oils and so on, what they had was a byproduct that was created by pressing the seeds, right? And so it was a slurry. And they said, well, geez, we want to make money on this. We want to make a value-added product out of this.
Instead of dumping it, let's try to sell it.
Exactly. So they spent a long time, a lot of money developing ways to create food around what is waste. It was waste. And so they develop your veggie burgers, veggie dogs, all sorts of soy products right now that are basically a waste product. And they said, second to that, they needed to come up with the hype, you know, with the PR to lure in conscientious consumers. So in the 1980s, they went after conscientious consumers. They went after the health food industry. And so the health food stores started lining their shelves with basically a product that should have been composted.
And in how well are you received by vegetarians and vegans?
Well, I warn vegetarians and vegans.
It doesn't
sound
like
warn them about these
diets.
I mean, there's a very, very nutrient deficient diet. The vast majority of my students and clients are recovering vegetarians and certainly vegans. Unfortunately, they end up on my doorstep saying, "Pam, help fix me." I'm, you know, they end up with a lot of fatigue, a lot of depression, anxiety, sleep problems, all sorts of health problems. And I'm a recovering.
It's the diet.
I know it's the diet.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm a recovering vegan myself. I mean, I was 9 years vegan. I thought it was going to help me overcome my chronic fatigue, and in the end, of course, it made my chronic fatigue much, much worse. So,
what helped you then?
Well, it's going back to basics, you know, and eating my eggs and my meat and my butter and
So you had chronic fatigue,
mm-hmm.
and you kept a strict diet, and nothing worked. And
I tried everything. I traveled thousands of miles, went to clinics and detoxed this and, you know, supplements.
And nothing.
And nothing was working until I really understood the animal fats and the role that they play. And you can see a systematic, you know, very clear distinction. What happened with our diets in the 1970s is when we started low-fat dieting. We really, really went hardcore in the 1970s with the low-fat industry. And in the 1980s, that's when people started dropping with chronic fatigue and Epstein-Barr and yuppie flu and all these things. That's when it started happening.
And to be honest, or to be fair, you're not deriding these people only because you, I mean, it's like, oh, it's all made up or something like that, like some people would, but you actually suffered from this.
Oh, yeah. I was basically bedridden for 12 years. I was deathly, deathly ill. And
really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I was very, very sick.
And you decided something, I've tried everything.
Uh-huh.
Meat can't hurt. Like, what was the
no,
turning
well, what
point?
Happened with me was, is after 9 years of being a vegan, I yeah. started craving eggs, and I kept saying, but I thought eggs were bad for me, you know? and sure enough, I'm thinking now, in hindsight, how silly that would have been, because my ancestors, as being Irish and Scottish, would have survived very nicely on eggs and meat and fish and shellfish and all these foods that I was mm-hmm. avoiding.
And so, when you first tasted meat again... I mean,
the endorphin release is amazing. You know, when I have people who come to me who have depression, yeah. fatigue, mental problems, psychological
right.
issues, and I get them on red meat and liver, of course, because it's even more nutrient dense than red meat, they report back to me all the time that they're feeling better. They finally have energy. They feel a burst of energy.
So you attribute your total change in diet, going from extreme veganism, I can say, or an extreme diet like a vegan diet, back to almost, an ancestral diet.
It's an ancestral diet. That's the way to describe it. And that's designed for.
Not the Paleolithic diet or the prehistoric diet. It's your ancestors grew up in a northern island atmosphere, Scottish and Irish. This is what they developed over mm-hmm. hundreds, if not thousands of years mm-hmm. and subsisted on the land and sea. So this is probably what your body is designed for.
My ancestors and your ancestors, Tom, because we're both of European descent, basically,
yeah, right.
would have gotten 70% of their calories from animal fat. And our dietary dictocrats here in Canada, at Health Canada, are with the new food guide coming out from the United States, which was just published hot off the press, they're going to try and tell us 10% of our calories should be coming from saturated fat. And even within the report from the United States is saying that as low as 7% of our calories should be coming from saturated fat. And this, to me, is criminal. This is going to create even more depression, more mood disorders, more addiction, more health problems overall.
Why doesn't anyone see... I guess in your book, you document a lot of people who make the link. You're just not conjuring this up. You have done the research and you look at, you know what, here's a study, here's another expert. But why don't those experts who are able to link diet and mood disorders or addictive personalities, but a rise in addictions, why aren't they getting... the press? Why are we taking note? Yeah. Or is it just so early that we're just discovering it?
Well, I think what happened is before World War II, nutrition was taught in the medical schools. And then after World War II, it was chemicals that were supposed to be our heroes, right? And that happened in agriculture and it happened in medicine. So in agriculture, the more inputs that were used on the land, of course, the more profits were made by the corporation.
Right, okay.
Same thing with the medical mafia as well. So you know, the more that they can put things in our bodies, on our bodies, more testing, the more procedures, the more money people will make. And of course, the irony behind that is that our ancestors were robustly healthy and didn't even have labs or universities or, you know, anything.
Yeah,
but at any rate, there's their irony. But at any rate, this whole idea that chemicals were going to be the heroes after World War II. And the PR that was used, and this was all basically PR that was learned from Edward Bernays, the father of propaganda. He was the nephew of Sigmund Freud, and he knew how to manipulate the masses. He knew how to create consensus. And one of the ways that they did it was by telling people who were anti-chemical that they were anti-progress. If you were anti-chemical, you were anti-progress. And you know, Tom, in 2011, even to this day, because I'm promoting nutrition, I am labeled as being anti-progress. This is how pervasive this idea is, that all of this chemicalization of society is somehow or another helping us. And when I look at the numbers and I look around me and I see how sick people are and I see that we're using chemical constraints, things like Ritalin, Seroquel, Risperdal, antipsychotic drugs on our children, what has happened to society today that we allow this to happen? When I know, and 100 years ago, we knew it was nutrition. I have a book. It's 100 years old. It was written by an authority in school feeding. And when a child had a behavior problem, they took that child out of school and put the boy or girl in a special school for 3 months. And you know what they did? They fed the child. They fed the child good nutrition. And they gave the child meat and butter, because they knew, especially if the child was coming from poverty, that in all likelihood, that child was not going to be eating those nutrient-dense foods. And that's what was causing that child to have those behavior problems. And this is true to this day. Those are more expensive foods to buy. So if people are coming from poverty, they're not going to be buying the butter and the meat. They're going to be buying cheaper foods. And it's going to starve their brains. And then you're going to see more of these mood disorders, both in children and in adults as well.
9:48 is our time. We've got to take a quick break. I got one segment left with Pam Colleen. She's the author of Addiction, The Hidden Epidemic, and making great case this morning about how the link is with our lack of nutrition, what we think we're feeding our bodies and everything we know and all that we've been given and how to be healthy is, in fact, the more you know, the less you know. That we have to flip it on its head. Everything that we've been fed, so to speak. Imagine everything you knew was wrong. I'll be back with one more segment with Pam Colleen next. This is News Talk 610 CKTV. All right, I got two emails I want to read, and you can address them. One, Billy says, Tommy, can you send me a link to your guest, please? Sounds like common sense, a rarity these days. Thanks, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
People want more information.
Oh, my website is pamcolleen.com. So it's pamkillen.com. And my email is pam@pamcolleen.com.
There you go. So Pam Colleen is the author. And you can Google her if you want. A lot of articles out there. And her website, pretty simple. Pamkillen.com. Killeen. All right. And then listen to Michael. Giving up bacon is likely the case of my depression. 10 years and no bacon. Could you imagine? I'm a vegetarian except for seafood. My wife and kids are vegetarian. My issue with meat is two things: the conditions that factory farms keep the animals in and the cost of producing meat from a land and grains. Could your guest address this?
Oh, absolutely. It's a great question. I mean, my first book, The Great Bird Flu Hoax, was basically about the very unhygienic conditions in and around factory farms. I'm against factory farms.
Okay. But so as much as you're encouraging meat production, there's also a problem with the production of meat.
Yes, okay. But there's a scale to work with, because I do work with people who have limited budgets and may not have a car to go out to a farm to buy their food, or for whatever reasons, there's maybe some limitations. So for people, I tell your baseline to start with is to eat 3 square meals. From that, you try and go for the gold standard. If you can get grass-fed meat from a local farmer, there's your gold standard. If you can't quite get that gold standard, then you will have to stick to an outer periphery of a grocery store. And that's okay, because, you know, I don't want people to starve their brains, especially for children. So
and
they
you're
need,
all about the brain.
All about the brain.
And that's where it all starts, isn't it? That there are some bodily issues with but you're talking about addiction, you're talking about mood disorders, you're talking about people's well-being, and this is mostly in our brain.
Absolutely. I mean, there's some very, you're only as healthy as your cell membrane. And your cell membrane needs these animal fats. They need complete protein in order to be structurally sound. And unfortunately today, you know, we're not structurally sound these days. So... So we need the right equipment to put our bodies together, and we're depriving our body of the right equipment. We're depriving our body of the right nutrients.
Now, briefly, we got a couple of minutes, and again tomorrow, if people want more information, come to your signing, 1 to 5 chapters on at Fairview Mall. What kind of people do you see? What kind of people come to you? And you do classes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you do seminars.
Mm-hmm.
You help coach people. Mm-hmm. Who are the people who seek you out?
Usually, they're recovering vegetarians. You know, with vegetarianism, because it's a risky diet to begin with, and there's a lot of nutritional deficiencies associated with it, the first symptoms that tend to happen with vegetarians is poor memory. Memory seems to go first, and then energy levels start to drop. So you see fatigue, you see depression, you see sleep problems, and cold hands, cold feet, because you're not getting enough fat generally to support the thyroid gland. So there's all very predictable symptoms based on malnutrition. And so I get a lot of recovering vegetarians who come to me, and I basically have to re-educate them and get them back on 3 square meals a day.
And are you going to see now, do you think, and you probably have within your students or people who follow you, a number of people with mood disorders or addictions?
Absolutely.
Do you think this is going to open up a new area or a person who hasn't thought of it being food-linked, that you're going to see a lot more people thinking, maybe my problem is related to my
diet? Yes, and I think what we need to do is we need to work politically at a grassroots level. This problem is not going to go away from the top down. We have to fix this problem. And we have a mental health commission here in Canada. It's probably the most expensive initiative in the world. Michael Kirby has launched it. He needs to read my book. You know, they're not looking at nutrition in terms of the solution. The solutions, unfortunately, are in the area and or talk therapy and or pharmaceutical drugs, and both have clear deficiencies attached to them. They're not really successful therapies
until you have a place, but not this giant silver bullet.
Absolutely, they have a place, but we need to accompany those therapies with nutrition in order to have more successful outcomes.
Pam, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much. What a fascinating hour.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, Tom.
Tomorrow, 1 to 5, Chapters, Fairview Mall for a signing. And, of course, we'll keep in touch. And I'd love to have you back as a guest.
That would be great.